This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
I invite your attention to the last chapter in the biography of this ordinary believer, Judges chapter 8. What was it that caused this man to fail in later years? Gideon led the people in an amazing victory over the Midianites. In fact, God's power was so wonderfully displayed that 120,000 of them killed each other, and Gideon chased the remaining 15,000 and drove them off the face of the earth as God's tool of judgment on the idolatrous nation. And what happens next you would almost expect to happen, because he has been the fearless leader. And the people come with an interesting proposition, which we find where we left off. That is verse 22. Look at it with me. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." Now, before we take a look at Gideon's answer, let's stop to observe the nation Israel, because they're not smelling like roses either here. You notice the words, "You have delivered us." The failure of Israel here is to acknowledge that God did the delivering. In fact, in Judges chapter 8, you'll not find one stitch of thanksgiving. In this entire chapter, you never read of the people stopping and saying, "God, thank you for delivering us from these oppressors that brought about famine-like living. Thank you." They never said it. Reminds me of Romans chapter 1, verse 21, where it talks about the unbeliever. As it says, though they knew God, they did not acknowledge him, nor did they thank him. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the chief characteristics of the unbeliever is that they do not show gratitude toward God for what God has done. And this is the Israelite nation here. So instead of thanking God, they thank Gideon. At the same time now, they tempt him with a very exciting proposition. "Gideon, we want you to be our king. In fact, we want your son to be our king, and his son." What are they asking? They are asking Gideon to be the first in a dynastic rule. He will be the first king, and his family will be the first dynasty in Israel. Very flattering. And the answer he gives is the high point of his career. From here on, it goes downhill. But look at it with me in verse 23. "Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.'" Fantastic answer. He's right on. Because God was the king in this theocracy. The nation would be ruled by God through prophet and through judge, not a man. And so Gideon responds by saying, "That would be wrong. God alone should be the king of Israel." If we could close the book here, end of chapter, end of story, end of biography, it would be wonderful. But the next verse reveals what will be a spiral downward in the life of this once great man. Look at the next verse, verse 24. "Yet Gideon said to them, 'I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil.' For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites." Verse 25. "And they said, 'We will surely give them.'" That is, this is the least that we can do for you. "So they spread out a garment, and every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. And the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks." Now, most scholars believe that this loot is valued in today's market at somewhere between $350,000 and $400,000. Now, when I read that verse, the first thought that came to my mind is probably what just came to yours. Uh-oh, Gideon, like so many others, has gotten greedy. But that isn't the case. In fact, the next verse gives us the motive for him requesting this gold. Verse 27, "And Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city, Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and to his household." The word snare means to allure and to entrap into ruin. This ephod will ruin. It will destroy Gideon's family. Now I have a couple of questions. First of all, why was making this ephod alluring to Gideon? And second of all, why would it destroy his family? What's so bad about that? Well, you need to understand, if we can back up for just a moment, that the ephod was very significant to Israelite worship. The ephod was fashioned something like an apron. It was part of the clothing. It was the outer garment of the high priest. The ephod also had a pouch in it in which were kept the Urim and the Thummim. We're never told what the Urim and the Thummim were, but these were the vehicles whereby God spoke to the high priest and through him to the people. It was the means of getting God's attention, as it were, and hearing from God. So what we have here is Gideon making an imitation ephod. And this, according to the scriptures, will destroy his life. In fact, it seems that he assumes the role that God never intended him to play, that is high priest. A counterfeit ephod, thus a counterfeit priesthood, and also, if you notice in that past verse, a counterfeit location for worship. We'll look there in just a moment, but here's where it gets interesting. Why would Gideon want to play priest and move worship to Ophrah? Well, the truth is, if we can put the clues together, the priesthood during Gideon's reign as judge was corrupt, immoral. At least it was ineffective. In fact, nowhere in the entire book of Judges do you read of a high priest fulfilling his function. You never read in this entire book of a high priest leading the people in worship. It's absent, and its absence, its silence, shouts, "Where are they?" Something's wrong. Furthermore, the tabernacle was located in Shiloh, where the place of worship was supposed to be at this point. Guess who controlled Shiloh? His favorite friends, the Ephraimites. You remember those from our last study? They jumped all over Gideon's back because he didn't invite them to fight with him. In fact, in chapter 12, they got onto another tribe for the same reason, and they responded by saying, "We're so upset, we're going to burn your house down." You remember that story? Well, these petty people controlled the center of worship, and the priesthood within that system were ineffective. And so perhaps Gideon reasoned in his own mind, "Wait a second, I'm the person that God has spoken to. I'm the leader. I'm the one whom God is using to lead these people. I'll take it one more step and I'll assume the role of high priest." It makes sense, but it won't work. In fact, Gideon here breaks three commands. Number one, Gideon was not qualified to wear the ephod. In Exodus chapter 28, God specifically says that only the Aaronic descendant could wear the ephod. Only the high priest, not Gideon. He has no right to assume priestly duties. Number two, the ephod was constructed with the wrong material. According to the Pentateuch, the ephod was to be constructed of blue material, not gold. Perhaps the people and Gideon himself were impressed by constructing an ephod out of this precious and rare metal. But then we should learn that God is not impressed by beauty. He is impressed by obedience. Number three, the most significant error is this perhaps. The ephod was in the wrong location. Gideon then instituted a rival form of priesthood, a rival form of worship, a rival location. Perhaps his motives were sincere, but he was sincerely wrong. Look back at the result in verse 27. "And all Israel played the harlot with it there." The words "play the harlot" always refer to spiritual failure, unfaithfulness. So God refers to Gideon's solution as spiritual adultery. He has no business making this ephod. The people have no business going to Ophrah to worship. They are committing spiritual unfaithfulness. That's what God has to say about what Gideon does. But maybe Gideon thought that God had made an exception for him. Leaders do that. They live by different rules. When will we ever learn that spiritual leaders do not have spiritual privileges? So what does God do? Look at verse 28 with me. "So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon." That is fascinating to me. Wait a second. All of these things have happened. Where's the thunder from heaven? The bolt of lightning, immediate judgment on a man who has gone haywire with his attempt to institute a rival form of worship. So, well, God must approve. Evidently, Gideon thought the same thing. But God does not make exceptions for him, nor does he for you and I, even though he has used our lives in the past Just because the heavens are silent when you and I sin does not mean that God is condoning the sin or that God isn't noticing. Right about now would have been a good time for a bolt of lightning, and it may have jolted Gideon back like some kid caught. Being caught sometimes is a good thing. I can remember my father had, when I was 16, this huge Buick LeSabre. It was about 15 years old. That was when they made them really big. Didn't have an air conditioner in it. We'd roll all four windows down. One summer, the summer after I got my license, my cousins and clan arrived from Minnesota. My favorite cousin, Mark, and I decided we'd go for a ride. So I asked Dad for the keys. And Dad gave them to me with that look that dads give 16-year-olds about to take a ride. And I said, you know, Dad, no problem. We're just gonna putz around the block a little bit. So he gave me the keys, and Mark and I got in. I was driving. Mark was sitting over on the passenger side. He looked at me and smiled, and I looked at him and smiled, and I just eased out of the driveway. All the family is out there, you know. And I probably went 5 miles an hour down the road, Red Brook Road, turned right, went about a half a mile, and came to an area which emptied out onto Military Highway, which was the main drag. There the light was red. And I looked at him, and he looked at me. I know this surprises you that I would ever do anything like this. But that light turned green, and I pushed that accelerator to the floor, and we took off. We were having a riot, and about that time, about 10 seconds later, we were up to about 65, 60 miles an hour, and I look in my rearview mirror, and I see billows of smoke coming out from underneath the car. And I'm not a mechanic, but I knew that billows of smoke should not be coming out from underneath the car. So I pulled over off of Military Highway, and my cousin and I knew, well, my cousin knew, that I was in trouble. We called my father, and my uncle, his brother, came to pick us up. And my uncle was driving, and Mark and I kind of slid into the back seat, and of course I said, you know, I have no idea why this happened. Of course, I can't understand it, but anyhow, something's wrong. And my father looked over at my uncle, who was a little bit more of a mechanic than him, and he said, well, he said, how does something like this happen? And my uncle floored it, and we shot forward. And my cousin and I slid down in our back seats, and I could have killed my uncle for doing that. You know, it's typical. Kids sneak around. Adults sneak around God. And sometimes we don't get caught. And it doesn't seem like God's going to move. Well, what happened here in his life was he was caught. But because the thunder didn't erupt from heaven, he kept going. And what happens here in this spiral downward is several things. Let me give you the first. Gideon's rival form of worship opened the door for national idolatry. Look at verse 33. We'll skip ahead a little bit. Then it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. It's as if the Israelites were waiting for this old judge to die. And as soon as he dies, well, we're already used to worshiping something else in some other location, in some other way. That's just the first step toward idolatry. And they were ready. Baal was already in their blood. Number two, Gideon's refusal to obey Scripture opened the door to further or personal sin. And three sins are revealed. The first one we've already talked about, but let me restate it. Number one, Gideon's lifestyle directly ignored the authority of Scripture. You and I, as he did, have two authorities in our lives. One, it's either the authority of this book, God is the author. And if we place ourselves under this authority, we're going to end well. But if I refuse to submit to the authority of the Word and pull myself out, I am in need of something to be the thing that calls the shots in my life. What's the authority? I become the authority. My feelings, my reasoning, my logic, my desires become the authority. And so what happens to Gideon? He follows the way of his flesh. Number two, Gideon's lifestyle degenerates into the pursuits of sensuality. Look at verse 29. Then Jerubbaal, that's his nickname, the Baal conqueror, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. And it must have been some house because verse 30 says, now Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. He, the famous leader, you know, leaders should have more, so he had more. This was a typical Canaanite perk of power. But it was a direct violation of Deuteronomy chapter 17, which Gideon knew. You will not multiply wives, period. Is Gideon fulfilled in this sensual lifestyle? No, look at verse 31. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son. Concubine is the social euphemism for mistress. He has perhaps 50 to 60 wives. Is he satisfied in his lifestyle? No. He's got something on the side down there in Shechem, which, by the way, is a Canaanite city. She's a Canaanite girl. And she bears him a son as well. Gideon's compromise is already destroying him. I came across a parable that they say is a Russian parable. A hunter was hunting in the woods for bear, and a bear came around the corner and pinned him to the ground. And the bear said, "Just what are you looking for?" And the hunter said, "Well, I'm looking for a warm fur coat." And the bear said, "Well, that makes sense. Perhaps we can negotiate. I'm looking for a full stomach. Perhaps we can come to a compromise." 30 minutes later, the bear ambles away, and on the ground is the hunter's cap and gun. And you're left to put the piece together, which you already have. The bear got his full stomach by eating the hunter. And the hunter got his warm fur coat. Perhaps you have been running well, but maybe just recently you have stopped to talk to some bear. It may be in the form of flirtation at the office, maybe in the form of fudging business accounts. It may come in the form of padding your expenses. It may come in the form of some subtle manipulation, some egotistical pursuit. It's a bear, and you are in the process of compromising. Perhaps it comes in the form of a test that you must cheat to pass. I was in the office of a president of a Bible college, and we were talking, and he happened to mention to me as we talked that there was a rash of cheating that had just broken out among the student body. Can you imagine a Christian student at a Bible college taking a test related to a biblical subject and cheating on it? That would be kind of like breaking into a Christian bookstore and stealing the Bible you've always wanted to have for your own. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Neither does Gideon's. My brother told me a story a couple of years ago about a fellow that he went to seminary with. This fellow was an excellent student, but my brother observed him in a Greek class cheating on a Greek exam. So after the class, he talked to him, confronted him about it, and he admitted it, that he had been cheating. In fact, he'd been cheating for some time, and he confessed to him. He, on his own volition, went to the prof, confessed, got things right, but something, my brother told me, still didn't seem right. They went through 4 years of seminary together, and on graduation day, God thundered from heaven. It seemed that this guy had been living with a girl, and he had told her, an unbeliever, that he was in law school. And they had evidently had quite a fight because she decided to kick him out, and she was packing his things. She came to some of his books, and she noticed that they were strange. They weren't law books. They were theology books. And stamped inside most of them, at least from the library, was the name of the seminary he attended. She called the seminary and asked, "Why does so-and-so have all of these books from your school?" And they looked at their records and they said, "Because he's a student here and he's about to graduate." A brother told me that two of the professors went out to that apartment. They met with her and then they waited for him to return home, unsuspecting. He was finally caught. The tragedy is that God sometimes takes disaster to stop us. And I wish that something had happened here, but God allows Gideon to self-destruct in his pursuit. I want to list the third thing that happens in Gideon's spiral downward. Number three, Gideon's lifestyle develops into the practice and pride of a king. Notice verse 31, which is a very short phrase, but yet it packs a punch. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. Now the words named him could be rendered appointed him. This is totally different than a little baby who's born and the father picks out a name that he would like to see his son have. It was typical in ancient day for the father to appoint a nickname for his grown son. In fact, Gideon, you remember, was nicknamed by his father Jerubbaal. That means my son is the Baal fighter. Well, Gideon gives his grown son a nickname, Abimelech. It means, my father is a king. You remember verse 23? The people said, Gideon, rule over us. And he said, no, I will not be your king. God is your king. And 40 years later, we read that he has developed because of his sensual lifestyle, his compromise. Now he comes to the point where he is feeling like, he is acting like, he has a king's harem. And now he is a son. And he has given him a nickname. And every time they call the son's name, it is a reference to the fact that Abimelech's father is a king. Everyone will lose. This will become the last period in the book of Judges where there is peace. The cycle stops here. You never read again of the nation Israel worshiping as a unit. The future judges will be tainted themselves with sin. A future one that you all know, Samson, will follow soon after Gideon. It seems that Gideon has lowered the standard for good. In the next chapter of the book of Judges, it will literally drip with the blood of his 70 sons who will be killed by Abimelech. The heavens did thunder. God did collect. Let me summarize this biography two ways quickly. Number one, faithlessness in the past may become faithfulness in the present. No matter how insignificant you may consider yourself, if you submit to the authority of God, God can use you. He used this timid farmer from Ophrah and made him a judge, made him a warrior, made him the Baal fighter. There is no telling what he can do with you and me if we submit to him. Gideon's faithlessness in the past became faithfulness in the present. But number two, faithfulness in the present may become failure in the future. And that's how Gideon's story ended. He was a great leader. A book in my library that is nearly 150 years old, composed of writings by many different men. Let me quote the words of this one commentator who lived nearly two centuries ago. God has a way, or two ways, of trying men. One in the furnace of affliction, and the other in the refining pot of prosperity. And this is the much harder trial of the two. Affliction tends to humble and soften and subdue. But in prosperity, self-esteem, self-reliance, self-satisfaction, self-will, pride, and security are prone to spring up with a rank luxuriance. The scriptures teach us here the danger of prosperity and the inability, notice this carefully, the inability of the human heart to drink a full cup of success without becoming intoxicated by success. This is the story of Gideon as you see him intoxicated by his own prosperity, his own success, his own prominence, his own status. You see him staggering and stumbling over the finish line. May we echo the words of the Apostle Paul who said, I have finished my race. I've run it well. I've finished my course. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. What is he talking about? Earning heaven? No. He's talking about a unique reward given those who finish the race, who end well, who submit to the authority of God, even in the last lap. If God should so choose to write today the last few words of your life and close the book on the biography of your life, would you have ended well? If His hand were to put down the divine pen that was recording the deeds, the acts, the thoughts, the passion, the purpose of your life, would it end well? I'm not talking about perfect people. I'm talking about progressing people who have a passion to follow God. May we learn from this man never to step out of the race, to keep running, to keep following, to keep submitting, so that we may end well.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.